Getting back to the Bolshevik Revolution, one of the ironies of it is that both Lenin and Trotsky were in exile, one in Germany, one in the United States. Tell us about how, who helped them get where they were going to make sure that revolution was pulled off.
Well, let me summarize about four chapters into 4 minutes. Trotsky was in New York. He had no income. I summed his income for the year he was in New York. It was about $600. Yet he lived in an apartment. He had a chauffeured limousine. He had a refrigerator, which is very rare in those days. He left New York and went to Canada on his way to the revolution. He had $10,000 in gold on him. He didn't earn more than $600 in New York. He was financed out of New York. There's no question about that. The British took him off the ship in Halifax, Canada. I got the Canadian archives. They knew who he was. They knew who Trotsky was. They knew he was going to start a revolution in Russia. Instructions from London came to put Trotsky back on the boat with his party and allow them to go forward. So there is no question that Woodrow Wilson, who issued the passport for Trotsky, and the New York financiers who financed Trotsky, and the British Foreign Office allowed Trotsky to perform his part in the revolution. Now, over in Switzerland, you get Lenin, who was in exile. He went through Germany in the famous sealed train by permission and with the encouragement of the German general staff. And yet Germany and Britain were supposed to be fighting each other. And you get them both moving these two key revolutionaries into place inside Russia. And then, of course, the rest is history. They created the revolution. With no more than about 10,000 revolutionaries, they needed assistance from the West, and they got assistance from Germany, from Britain, and from the United States to continue and consolidate the revolution.
Just tell us all over again why.
Why?
Just tell
you won't find this in the textbooks. Why is to bring about, I suspect, a plan to control world society in which you and I won't find the freedoms to believe and think and do as we believe.
Did these power brokers actually envision at that time a one-world government that would be socialist?
Yes. The second statement I made was that they did not want the Soviet Union to develop into another free enterprise society, and that this would offset it. Aiding the revolution would offset this event. That was made as a statement in 1919. You have various books, one by Gillette, the razor blade Gillette, called The City, I think it was, which laid out this corporate socialism for the world to see as early as, what, 1905, 1910. So around the turn of the century, you begin to see actually written statements by these internationalist businessmen of the kind of socialist empire they wanted to bring about. It's there, but these books, of course, are not included in your courses in political science and history at the regular universities.
Well, talk about the Red Cross mission.
Red Cross mission to Russia, 1918.
That's 17. Bankers, lawyers, businessmen.
We have said
a couple of doctors.
A couple of, there were two doctors, I think. There were two doctors.
What was the mission?
The mission was financed by William Boyce Thompson, the Chase Manhattan Bank, Federal Reserve System. The Red Cross didn't want to send the mission. Red Cross said, we don't need a mission to Russia. They already had one in Romania, which was doing a good job. But William Boyce Thompson wanted this mission, and he put the money up. He financed it. And if you look, I printed a list of the people on the mission, and they were mostly bankers and lawyers, Wall Street lawyers, and people in and around the Wall Street establishment. The function or the purpose of this mission was to be in place to assist the Bolshevik Revolution. The Red Cross mission to Russia was a cover vehicle. It enabled these Wall Street elitists, these Wall Street manipulators to be there in place. And then I traced a cable, $1 million from the Morgan Company in New York to Petrograd. I forget to which bank, but it came from William Boyce Thompson, and which financed the revolution. And then they put pressure back in the State Department in Washington to actually send arms to the revolution, which went forward in 1918. And then I found in the State Department files an extraordinary telegram in which Trotsky appealed to the State Department to send American army instructors to train the new Soviet army. And I think I reprinted that in one of my earlier books. So briefly, the Red Cross mission was a cover vehicle to enable Wall Street to be there in place to guide and manipulate the ongoing Bolshevik revolution.
What was the response of the State Department?
Oh, yes, they were quite willing to send U.S. arm instructors.
Do you know how, to
I don't know if they went forward. I know the arms, I know the rifles went forward. I didn't trace the response to the telegram, except it was approved within the State Department. And I reprinted the telegram. I never did find a response. That's probably taken out the files.
Do you know the figure to which Wall Street supported the Bolsheviks?
Well, it was $1 million.
Just the William Boyce Thompson figure?
That figure. But then you've got the other assistants. For example, the whole Siberian episode. See, in 1918, the Bolsheviks really only controlled Moscow and what was then Petrograd, which is now Leningrad. They could not have beaten off the White Russians, the Czechs, who were in Russia at that time, the Japanese, who were anti-Bolshevik. They could not have beaten it off without assistance from the United States and from Britain. And the Siberian Railroad is critical because if you look at that map of Russia, you know, Moscow is, and Leningrad are stuck at the left end, and you've got the vast expanse of Russia, which, and the backbone is the Trans-Siberian Railroad. Now, the history books will tell you that American troops went in, they occupied the Trans-Siberian Railroad in order to prevent the Japanese from coming in. Well, this is absolute nonsense. I've never written the book. I hope to get around to it one day. I've got two big boxes of files on this. The purpose of the American army in Siberia was to hold the Trans-Siberian Railroad until the Bolsheviks were strong enough to take it over. And they did that very effectively. They held off the Japanese. They held them back near Manchuria. They evacuated the Czechs out along the Trans-Siberian Railroad. The French and the British gave up because they said the Americans are helping the Bolsheviks. They evacuated. And in one of these books, I reprinted a little clipping from the New York Times of, I think, 1919. Finally, the Bolsheviks got to Vladivostok, right at the far end of Siberia, near Japan, in which the local commissar addressed the American army and thanked them for aiding the revolution. And that was in the New York Times, and I reprinted it. Now, this is totally contrary to everything you find in the textbooks. The textbooks say we went into Siberia to at least be neutral, and I suppose most people would assume we went in to stop the Bolsheviks. We didn't. We went in to help the Bolsheviks. There's no question about that.
There's no question that they could not have consolidated their revolution without the capitalists.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. They had too many enemies. Not only outside enemies, the White Russians. The Ukrainians themselves were not particularly happy. All your ethnic groups in Russia were not particularly happy with the Bolsheviks. They could not have won without Western assistance. There is no question about that. Then they were starving. The factory, they couldn't operate the factories because the Bolsheviks shot all the managers and the technicians. Either that or they left Russia. The factories were closed down. Russia was starving. By 1922, Lenin himself said the end has come. They had no food. They had these closed down plants. The plants were not destroyed in the revolution. That's what the textbooks will tell you, including Kennan, the State Department expert. He says the Russian factories were destroyed in the revolution. They were not destroyed. Why? Because I've seen the photographs after the revolution, and they're right in the Hoover Institution Tower. There are these massive boxes of photographs of Russian industry after the revolution. They could not operate the plants. So what do we do with Avril Harriman and the Chase Bank and National Bank and our old friends on Wall Street? They go in there, and of course the Hoover mission to feed Russia. We go in there and we have these 250, 300 concessions in which American companies went into Russia, and they started up the idle plants. Avril Harriman took the manganese concessions. Armand Hammer, Occidental Petroleum, took the pencil factories and the asbestos plants. And all these top capitalists went in and they got Russia going on behalf of the Bolsheviks, because the Bolsheviks either shot or kicked out all the people who could run, all the Russians who could run the plants. Another point, the Tsarist industry was at a very high level. Your textbooks would tell you that Tsarist industry was backward. It wasn't until the Soviets came along that it began to make progress. This is absolute nonsense. The Soviets, the Russians in 1913 had two indigenous Russian vehicles, Russian automobiles. There has never been an indigenous Soviet automobile. They've all come from the West. The Tsarist Russians produced an airplane in 1916 with a wingspan longer than the 747. This is not known today. It's just wiped out history. Technologically, the Tsarist Russians were at least on a par with the rest of the world. They only began to decline when the Soviets took over. And then you've got the long history from that point onwards, how you got the first five-year plan, 1929, 1933. I look at the first five-year plan, I look at every plant that was built in Russia at that time. Every single plant was built by a Western company. Not one single plant was built by the Soviets. You name any plant, if there are any Russians here from way back, you name any plant in the first five-year plan, and you know as well as I do who built it. It wasn't the Soviets, it was a Western company. And you run down the list, Caterpillar tractor. There are more Caterpillar tractors in the Soviet Union than there are outside the Soviet Union. Ford, Ford Model A, Ford built the Gorky plant. And as soon as the Ford engineers left, they started to turn out military vehicles. You name it, in the first five-year plan, every single plant was built basically by American companies, but a lot of British, French, and German, and Japanese were in there too. Then the second five-year plan in the 1930s was a duplicate. They tried to copy the first five-year plan with their own resources. They fell flat on their faces, and they had to come back to the Western companies for assistance to duplicate the plants put in the first five-year plan. And for example, I was in Douglas Aircraft Company, they let me into their files, and it was amazing the detailed assistance given by Douglas Aircraft. They bought one DC-3, and then they bought a DC-3 in sub-assembly, and all kinds of duplicate spare parts to get the thing going. And then we've got that story, I don't know how much detail you want, which continues right up to today, July 1, 1987, and you mentioned, I think, this morning, the Toshiba and the Toshiba Japanese plant and the Norwegian company, a government-owned plant, which provided the milling machines, which enabled now the Soviet submarines to be 10 times quieter than they were before, and that's going to cost us $4 billion so that we can offset what we have given them. And this stupidity has continued stupidity in my sense. From the viewpoint of a Wall Street capitalist, I guess it's smart business. This has continued for 60 years.
And this supposedly by our allies, but this is not the people of Japan and Norway.
No.
This is again the internationalists.
It's the internationalists. Toshiba represented on the Trilateral Commission, founded by David Rockefeller in 1973. It's your top corporate elitists, your top corporate establishment attorneys, your top politicians. Senator Mansfield once said, you don't get along unless you go along.
Stand. Well, now, I mean, the ultimate, you know, for instance, here, the ultimate, you keep hearing, you know, the controlled right, the controlled left. They like to use all these phrases. Like, for instance, fuck news and hush matzo ball and these kind of control people on the right, on the fake right. Like to use the term all the time, you know, we're headed to communism. We're headed into, you know, this leftist communist. No. It's far, far from the truth. As a matter of fact, what the neo-left represents in Europe and the United States is not traditional communism. What it is it is neo-corporatism. That's exactly what it is, because the Oy Veys, remember, communism was created by the Oy Vey banking class. Communism was created by those who controlled capital, by your capitalist class, by your upper levels. It never would have came into existence.
They are
without the Jewish banking system, without the capitalist societies, the upper crust of the kosher capitalist societies who financed it directly to have their revolutions. And the only reason it was created to have a division globally, but also a redistribution of wealth and a destruction of competition to their monopolistic capital, which they have at the top of the JWO pyramid. A lot of people don't understand this, but
bingo. You know, that's what happened in 1913 when the capitalist Jews in the United States were sending all this money to the Soviet Union, creating this it appears as if it's a divide, as if capitalism and communism are against each other.
Same thing.
But they're two wings of the same Jew vertebrae, folks. It's the same Hegelian dialectic. They have it on multiple levels. And that's what they do. Every level. Yeah. They do that.
But they do this in every aspect of life. Remember, it's called Jewish duality. This is the Hegelian dialectic. You know, and they don't like, I'm going to tell you this, because of Talmudic magic and those that understand their spiritual essence will understand, they only like two. It has to be in a straight division of two for their stuff to work the way they want it. And that's why they, in this country, for instance, don't like the idea of a third political movement. They don't like the idea of a new system. It has to be two.
They only like it when it serves their purpose.
Right,
Ross Perot.
Yeah, sure. But for the most part, that they like this division of two, and that's the way they have it. And they have that not only in politics, but look, they have it in every aspect of life. They have it with you have Oy Vey divide in politics, red versus blue, right? You have Oy Vey divide in sexes with feminism, MGTOW. You have Oy Vey divides in the way you eat with radical vegetarianism and radical carnivorism.
Even
you
have Pepsi Coke.
Yeah, Pepsi Coke. Yeah, which by the way is red and blue, by the way.
In many ways, international capitalism and international communism are two sides of the same Talmudic coin. Both are internationalistic. Both are materialistic. And in the end, both communism and capitalism would, if taken to their philosophical extremes, lead to more or less the same result. The final state of communism and capitalism is called Mammonism, where everything belongs to one person or party. What difference is it if all the property of the world belongs to a communist collective run by Jews, or belongs to a few big Jewish mega corporations? Communism as we know it was funded entirely through capitalistic efforts, as Jews on Wall Street saw Jews in the revolution as being their brothers and comrades in arms. Many even say that communism is simply political Judaism. Of course, understand that critiquing international capitalism doesn't mean being against private property, or owning a business, or growing your wealth. Those things, by themselves, are not evil at all and should be encouraged. One can even make an argument for some type of limited or smaller financial market. For example, the earliest options and futures markets were developed in medieval Japan to help farmers guarantee a stable income for their crops. However, in our modern society, these areas have become so cancerous, so bloated thanks to Jewish capitalism, that they've become parasitical institutions rotting our society from the inside out. Extreme Jewish capitalism has effectively become a cancerous growth, where profit comes above the well-being and prosperity of one's race. After all, in a Jewish capitalistic world, where financial value is what matters, being a good stay-at-home mother has no economic value. Yet, a good mother is perhaps one of the most important things anyone can ever have in their life. That's just one example of what I'm talking about, and how a third position political or economic model, like National Socialism, gets things right. The problem, however, is that most people who critique certain aspects of capitalism do so from a communist left-leaning perspective. These people are just unwitting pawns to this system, stuck in the false dichotomy of modern political economic thinking. In truth, true third position economic theory is an entirely evolution of thinking. Just as feudalism no longer exists as a legitimate economic model, third position economics would render both Jewish capitalism and Jewish communism equally invalidate as archaic, outdated systems. That might be hard for some people to digest, as it was for myself as a former libertarian and follower of Austrian economics, but the world will never change if we keep valuing dollars over the well-being of our folk, our race, and our civilization.
Two men live in two different countries, one blue and one red. Both men are at the beginning of their adult lives. The man in blue enters college, and the man in red enlists in the military. While one learns social justice, the other fights for his country. Both receive health care and training from the state. But in order for the man in red to maintain his benefits, he must complete his term of service. While in the Blue Nation, all of these benefits are universal. Are these two countries socialist? It is likely you would only call the Blue State socialist. But why? Organizationally, they are identical. Both centralized governments disrupt the free market, and both men benefit off the taxpayer's dime. The critical difference is not how each state operates, but what they accomplish. The Blue State awards its citizens for simply existing. They can be unhealthy, lazy, or selfish, and receive benefits all the same. While in the Red State awards its citizens for service. Service that holds men to a standard of behavior that is beneficial to the nation. The question we should be asking is whether or not the two states are implementing the same kind of socialism. Today, mainstream politics exclusively associates socialism with the left. However, socialism is also implemented by the right. There are two kinds of socialism, one that weakens and the other which strengthens the people. After his time in college is complete, the man in blue will either have no marketable skills or he will be competing in a job market with thousands upon thousands of individuals who graduated with the same degree that he has, fighting for the same job. His indoctrination in gender studies, diversity, and cultural Marxist rhetoric will ruin his chances of building a healthy family, if he is even capable. As a result, he and his children will remain reliant on the state, assuming that he has any. The influence of government grows constantly in the Blue Nation. As new weaknesses arise in the population, they require more public intervention, whether it be providing medication, food stamps, or enlarging the police force. This kind of socialism is a straight path to a dystopian nanny state. Meanwhile, in the Red State, after being discharged from the military, the man in red has many useful skills. He is in the perfect situation to build a strong family that does not require public assistance. Because of nationalist policy, his children will have more opportunity to act independently from the state. This kind of socialism limits its own power. The government uses benefits to encourage training in combat, giving its citizens the ability to fight against both foreign invasions and domestic tyrants. In the Red Country, there is little need for public programs. The population is healthy, industrious, and morally sane. If two socialist states can be complete opposites, then their socialism must have different names. One of them is Marxism, and the other is National Socialism. National Socialism is socialist policy with the express purpose of empowering the people, not the state. Unlike Marxism, where a welfare regime is the ultimate end, government in National Socialism is simply a tool. Its goal is to create men who are capable of protecting and growing their people. Since race determines the inherent qualities of a people, National Socialism preserves the country as both a cultural and biological entity. Our loyalty is not to a man or a state, but to our blood. We obey a government so long as it is in the interest of the families and communities that compose the nation. Call it hateful. Call it collectivism. We call it serving something greater.
With that in mind, let's see what the world's most famous Austrian painter had to say about this topic.
In dieser englisch-französischen Welt, da existiert eine sogenannte Demokratie. Sie wissen ja. Diese Demokratie zeichnet sich nun durch Folgendes aus. Es heißt, dass das die Herrschaft des Volkes sei. Nun muss das Volk ja doch irgendeine Möglichkeit besitzen, seinen Gedanken oder seinen Wünschen Ausdruck zu geben. Wenn man sich nun näher dieses Problem ansieht, dann kann man feststellen, dass das Volk an sich primär dort gar keine Überzeugung hat, sondern die Überzeugung selbstverständlich, wie übrigens überall, vorgesetzt erhält. Und das Entscheidende ist nun, wer setzt diese Überzeugung eines Volkes fest? Wer klärt ein Volk auf? Wer bildet ein Volk? In diesen Ländern regiert tatsächlich das Kapital. Das heißt, es ist eine Schar von 100 Menschen letzten Endes, die im Besitz unermesslicher Vermögen sind und die infolge der eigenartigen Konstruktion des Staatslebens dort mehr oder weniger gänzlich unabhängig und frei sind. Denn das heißt, wir haben hier Freiheit und sie meinen damit vor allem freie Wirtschaft. Und unter freier Wirtschaft wieder verstehen Sie die Freiheit, Kapital nicht nur zu erwerben, sondern auch vor allem Kapital frei wieder zu verwenden. Frei zu sein in der Erwerbung des Kapitals von jeder staatlichen, das heißt volkslichen Aufsicht, aber auch in der Verwendung des Kapitals frei zu sein von jeder staatlichen und volkslichen Aufsicht. Das ist in Wirklichkeit der Begriff Ihrer Freiheit. Und dieses Kapital nun, es schafft sich zunächst seine Presse. Sie reden von der Freiheit der Presse. In Wirklichkeit hat jede dieser Zeitungen einen Herrn. Und dieser Herr ist in jedem Fall der Geldgeber. Der Besitzer also. Und dieser Herr dirigiert nun das innere Bild dieser Zeitung, nicht der Redakteur. Wenn der heute etwas anderes schreiben will, als dem Herrn passt, dann fliegt er am nächsten Tag hinaus. Diese Presse nun, die die absolute, unterwürfige, charakterlose Kanaille ihrer Besitzer ist. Diese Presse moduliert nun die öffentliche Meinung. Und die von dieser Presse mobilisierte öffentliche Meinung wird wieder eingeteilt in Parteien. Diese Parteien unterscheiden sich so wenig voneinander, als sie sich früher bei uns voneinander unterschieden haben. Sie kennen sie ja, die alten Parteien. Das war immer eines und dasselbe. Meistens ist es sogar in diesen Ländern so, dass die Familien aufgeteilt sind. Einer ist konservativ und der andere ist liberal. Und ein dritter, der ist in England bei der Arbeiterpartei. In Wirklichkeit sind alle drei Familienmitglieder jährlich beisammen und dirigieren ganz genau ihre weitere Haltung. Legen Sie fest. Es kommt noch dazu, dass das auserwählte Volk ja überall eine Gemeinschaft ist und nun tatsächlich alle diese Organisationen bewegt und dirigiert. Daher kommt auch bei einer Opposition dort nichts heraus. Die Opposition ist eigentlich immer das Gleiche. Und in allen grundsätzlichen Dingen, wo sich doch die Opposition bemerkbar machen müsste, sind sie immer eins und das Gleiche. Da haben sie eine Überzeugung. Diese Parteien mit dieser Presse, die formen die öffentliche Meinung. Nun müsste man doch meinen, dass vor allem in diesen Ländern der Freiheit und des Reichtums ein unerhörtes Wohlleben für das Volk bestehen müsste. Es ist aber umgekehrt. In diesen Ländern ist die Not der breiten Masse größer als irgendwo anders. Da ist dieses reiche England. 40 Millionen Quadratkilometer werden von ihm kontrolliert. Hunderte Millionen kolonialer Arbeiter mit einem erbärmlichen Lebensstandard in Indien zum Beispiel müssen dafür tätig sein. Man müsste nun meinen, in diesem England selbst, da muss dann wenigstens noch jeder einzelne Teilhaber an diesem Reichtum sein. Im Gegenteil, in diesen Ländern ist der Klassenunterschied der krasseste, den man sich denken kann. Armut, unvorstellbare Armut auf der einen Seite und auf der anderen ebenso unvorstellbarer Reichtum. Sie haben nicht ein Problem gelöst. Das sind Länder, die über die Fetten der Erde verfügen. Und ihre Arbeiter, die hausen in erbärmlichen Lücken. Länder, die über die Bodenschätze der Welt verfügen. Und die breite Masse ist miserabel gekleidet. Länder, die mehr als genügend an Brot und an allen solchen Früchten haben könnten. Und Millionen ihrer unteren Schichten haben nicht genug, um sich nur den Magen einmal vollzufüllen, laufen verhungert herum. Leute, die auf der einen Seite es fertigbringen könnten, eine Welt mit Arbeit zu versehen, müssen es erleben, dass sie nicht einmal mit der Erwerbslosigkeit in ihrem eigenen Lande aufräumen können. Dieses reiche England hat jahrzehntelang jetzt 2,5 Millionen Erwerbslose gehabt. Dieses reiche Amerika, 10 bis 13 Millionen Jahr für Jahr. Dieses Frankreich, sechs, sieben, achthunderttausend. Ja, meine Volksgenossen, was wollten wir dann erst von uns sagen? Aber es ist auch verständlich, in diesen Ländern der sogenannten Demokratie wird ja überhaupt gar nicht das Volk in den Mittelpunkt der Betrachtung gerückt. Was entscheidend ist, ist ausschließlich die Existenz dieser paar Macher der Demokratie. Das heißt also, die Existenz dieser paar hundert gigantischen Kapitalisten, die im Besitz ihrer ganzen Werke, ihrer ganzen Aktien sind und die letzten Endes damit diese Völker ausschließlich dirigieren. Die breite Masse interessiert sie nicht im geringsten. Die interessiert sie genau wie früher unsere bürgerlichen Parteien nur die Wahlzeit. Dann brauchen sie Stimmen. Sonst ist ihnen das Leben der breiten Masse vollkommen gleichgültig. Dazu kommt noch der Unterschied der Bildung. Ist es nicht geradezu spaßhaft, wenn wir jetzt hören, dass ein englischer Arbeiterparteiler, der im Übrigen als Oppositioneller von der Regierung offiziell bezahlt wird, wenn ein englischer Arbeiterparteiler sagt, wenn der Krieg zu Ende geht, dann wollen wir auch in sozialer Hinsicht einiges machen. Vor allem, es soll dann auch der englische Arbeiter einmal reisen können. Das ist ausgezeichnet, dass sie jetzt draufkommen, dass das Reisen nicht nur für Millionäre da sein soll, sondern auch für das Volk. Das haben wir aber bei uns schon immerhin seit einiger Zeit gelöst, diese Probleme. Nein, glauben Sie, in diesen Staaten, das zeigt ihre ganze Wirtschaftsstruktur, da herrscht letzten Endes unter dem Mantel der Demokratie der Egoismus einer verhältnismäßig ganz kleinen Schicht. Und diese Schicht wird nun von niemand korrigiert und kontrolliert. Und es ist verständlich, wenn daher ein Engländer sagt, wir wollen nicht, dass unsere Welt irgendwie zugrunde geht. Sie haben recht. Sie wissen ganz genau, ihr Imperium wird von uns gar nicht bedroht. Aber Sie sagen sie mit Recht, wenn diese Gedanken, die in Deutschland populär werden, nicht beseitigt und ausgerottet werden, dann kommen sie auch über unser Volk. Und das ist das Gefährliche. Das wünschen wir nicht. Es würde ihnen gar nicht schaden, wenn es käme. Aber sie sind so borniert, wie bei uns auch viele borniert waren. Sie lieben auf dem Gebiet einfach ihre konservative, bisherige Praxis. Sie wollen sich davon nicht entfernen. Sie machen kein Hehl daraus. Sie sagen, diese ganzen Methoden passen uns nicht. Und was sind denn das für Methoden? Ja, wissen Sie, meine Kameraden, ich habe ja in Deutschland nichts zerschlagen. Ich bin immer sehr positiv vorgegangen. Weil ich, wie gesagt, glaube, dass wir uns das gar nicht erlauben können, etwas in Trümmer zu legen. Es war mein Stolz, dass die Revolution 33 ohne eine kaputte Fensterscheibe abging. Aber trotzdem haben wir ungeheure Wandlungen herbeigeführt.